toi te rangi marie, o rangi nui e tui honei, o papu tuanuku e takatonei, o te tai o e awhinei I a tātou, ti hei Māori ora. This is The Green Desk on 95BFM.
Whitebait fritters are a nationally iconic delicacy, but if we aren't careful, soon there may not be enough of the fish left to fill those fritters. When we talk about whitebait, that's really just a catch-all term for the juveniles of six species of fish, five of which are migratory galaxids, specifically the eelinga, banded kōkapu, giant kōkapu, kōaro, and the short-jaw kōkapu. The sixth species is common smelt. Recently, three of these species were updated to the threat status of at-risk declining, and a fourth has been labelled as threatened. It's not surprising then that in a 2018 nationwide survey, 90% of respondents said changes were needed to make New Zealand whitebait fishery sustainable. But exactly what are the right changes to be making? Conservation Minister Eugenie Sage believes the answer is through regulation, and has made a number of proposals which are currently open to public submission. These include the creation of whitebait refuges, removing traps from nets, and shortening the whitebait fishing season. However, for someone who says action is needed further upstream, if you excuse the pun, I spoke to Hans Rook about the approach taken in the Hawke's Bay. Rook is a dedicated conservationist who worked for more than 42 years in the field, before retiring 5 years ago in order to spend even more time on conservation work. Rook has been involved in the creation and protection of whitebait spawning sites since 1987, a hugely successful initiative which has led to the Hawke's Bay being the only place in the country to have an increasing whitebait population. I spoke to him about his thoughts on the sustainability of whitebait fisheries, as well as the proposed regulations. He started by telling me about the life cycle of the fish species, which we know as whitebait.
Well, pretty much they're born in what they term the saltwater wedge, which is where the freshwater and the saltwater mix, and that's where they deposit their eggs. And the reason for that's very simple, because if they were to lay eggs above that site, outside the tidal lift and fall, those eggs would never be floated out of the grass and go from egg to larvae and then go out through your river mouth. But they'll get sucked out through our river mouths and they'll develop in our coastal waters probably for about 3 to 4 months. And then it's the young or the juveniles or the babies, that's what we term as whitebait. You know, we're not harvesting the adults that lay the eggs, we're fishing for the juvenile. And some of those females will put out 2,500-3,000 eggs each. And yeah, that's how it works. You know, an animal with a short lifespan will produce a phenomenal number of eggs. And that's Mother Nature's way of working out your carrying capacity or your balance, if you like, with the environment.
Because I guess there would be some concerns when you're talking about fishing the incoming generation. When you're fishing the juveniles, you're kind of taking the population, you're giving it a knock at the knees.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, that one. I think we've sort of got a little bit carried away with our imagination. It is sustainable. We've got huge runs of fish that occur when the whitebait season finishes on the 30th of November, right through to Christmas. And then you also get it over the winter months. If we were harvesting adults that were laying the eggs, I would be very concerned, and I would have a totally agree with a total ban on whitebaiting, but we don't. And it's in that juvenile form that it's sustainable.
You're saying it's possible to fish whitebait sustainably, yet if you look around the country, the threat status of these species is seriously declining and in quite a lot of danger. So how do we reconcile those two? What is it that's causing that?
A lot of it is land use, and what I mean by that is just a little bit of a buffer between your water margins and alternative land use. You know, it might be forestry, it might be pastoral. The farming one's really quite an interesting one, actually. You know, farmers are taking a pretty bad rap, and I find that extremely unfair. Some of the work that's been done around here, you know, from within the farming community and farmer-driven, would make your eyes water. Some of the water and soil conservation initiatives that have been undertaken in this district here, especially, and I suspect it would be all around the country, we've got to think that everything's connected and everything is linked. The key to it's everybody working together, and some of the work that the regional councils has done here is just absolutely breathtaking. You know, we've got 3 kilometres of fencing up on known spawning sites where we've actually seen the fish laying eggs, and we've also built spawning sites. We've attacked it from a whole lot of different angles. Fish passes, riparian fencing, water margin edges, building habitat with 20-ton diggers. And we can beautifully blueprint that outside the Hawke's Bay, and we can apply it to any area in New Zealand and get the same results. It's really simple, you know. If you want to stop a cattle beast from going to the toilet in a creek, it's called a fence. And, you know, if we can stick a man on the moon from Earth, we can fix our whitebait fisheries anywhere around New Zealand. That's the way forward, is habitat. And we need to focus on that first. Try that. If it doesn't work, we can chuck in a whole wolf edge full of regulations. But quite frankly, from where I've been sitting since 1987, the whole key to the whole thing is whitebait habitat.
And what you're talking about is as simple as just putting in a fence, right, to stop livestock from trampling that spawning habitat on the riparian area. And what I like about that too is that we're already having conversations about the need for farmers to fence off their rivers just for water quality as well.
Yeah, there's the win-win, because it dovetails in beautifully with, you know, everything's connected, and we've got to keep that absolutely focused and right in front of us. That's the target.
So your main approach is that what we need to do is create the spawning habitat to ensure the sustainability of these whitebait species. How did you come around to that realisation, and how do you do that? How do you create a good spawning site?
When we started in 1987, we had a fishery on the point of collapse here. Our local people would fish for a whole week, and they'd get enough for a fritter that would fit in the palm of your cupped hand. Once we started doing this fencing work, about a year and a half, 2 years out, all of a sudden the fishery started to bounce back massively. And on many of those sites, that probably would have been the first time since, well, pretty much after the war actually, that these fish actually had a permanent and a safe place to deposit their eggs. And we're managing those sites now to get maximum production out of them. Because if you've got silver poplar overhanging these sites, what they'll do is suppress a lot of the desirable vegetation that you need underneath those trees for the fish to actually deposit their eggs in safely.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting talking about vegetation, how Inanga in particular prefer to spawn in these two invasive grass species.
That's fascinating, that one, because I'm not sure what they would have deposited their eggs within in the early time. I suspect it may have been ropeworm, but it's quite fascinating when you look at the density of eggs in these two introduced grasses on the East Coast Hawke's Bay spawning sites. And one of them's creeping bent, and the other one is tall fescue. Both introduced pasture grasses brought in. You know, I'll play devil's advocate here. Maybe those two introduced species might have been better than what Inanga actually laid their eggs in originally anyway.
Yeah, it's crazy. Things like that can kind of turn our entire conception of conservation on its head.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about the regulations that are currently being discussed and the proposed changes. Conservation Minister Eugenie Sage has mentioned such changes as restricting the fishing season, creating these refuges, and also banning certain types of nets. And I wanted to know what your thoughts on that were from a Hawke's Bay context.
You know, I think we're focusing at the problem at the wrong end. We need to focus on the ambulance at the top of the cliff and not worry about the one at the bottom. You know, just the impact of banning traps in whitebait nets, that's going to have huge significance and impact on a lot of old people that are about 70 plus that fish off whitebait jetties further back up the river. If you took the trap out of the inside of a net, if you're an old person, you'd have to go down and lift the net every 5 minutes. And those old people are just not physically capable of that. And I know what's going to happen. They're going to abandon fishing off structures further back up the river, and they're going to have a go at river mouths. And we're going to be responsible for drowning a lot of pensioners at river mouths, because they're not going to give up fishing.
Forrest and Bird actually think that these proposed regulations don't go far enough. They actually want to see a catch limit imposed, as well as licensing and more data collected on catches. What do you say to those people at Forrest and Bird?
I don't think that's the way forward. I really don't. Probably the better way to go would be to say, okay, we've got a West Coast fishery that's sustainable, because we've been trying to commercially exterminate it for over 100 years and we haven't succeeded. For our recreational fishery, my attitude to it is, well, okay, so why don't we take it a step further and we really deal with a real issue? Why don't we make it illegal to sell recreationally caught white bait? And if you take the commercial incentive out of it, you're going to get rid of a whole lot of the other downstream problems that go with that, you know, law enforcement problems and all sorts of stuff.
And I think a lot of pushback against these white bait regulations comes from the fact that a lot of our knowledge of white baiting and regulation comes from the West Coast, and how certain things that work in the West Coast might not apply in other places of the country.
Exactly. And I'll just pick on smelt for that. It's not harvested on the West Coast, so they've got a back peg in there. You can't fish further back than the tidal influence. But to catch smelt, you've got to have fast-flowing fresh water. So you're going to be fishing above the tidal influence, so you have a back peg that says you're not allowed to fish any further up the river. That's fine in theory for the West Coast, because they don't harvest smelt on the West Coast. But they certainly do in the North Island, so I really think we should retain the West Coast fishery exactly the way it is and leave our recreational fishery, which is outside the coast, just leave it the way it is. There's no need to change it. And for the smelt fishery, that's extremely important to iwi. A lot of our old people sort of target smelt, and they take a great pride if they have visitors to be able to actually put on meals of smelt on the marae, and that's a source of enormous pride for them. And that comes from their local rivers. And those local rivers are regarded as the supermarket that never closes and as a food source for them. And I saw that here when the Whakatū Meatworks closed, and a lot of these boys were out of a job, but they fell back on the river. That kept them afloat until they got their bearings and got other jobs, and that put food on the table. You know, we've got to remember that in New Zealand. You can't eat money.
Yeah, and I think that's something interesting about white bait, is it's not just an environmental problem, but it's also a social problem.
Yeah, the other one is, there's a saying, if you don't use it, you'll lose it. If people are utilising a resource, say like white bait or smelt, then it gives those rivers or those awa a value, and it's a very, very strong connection, and our people will stand up to protect those rivers and streams and tributaries, and that's a good thing. And that goes in beautifully parallel to water and soil conservation values, a lot of the aspirations of regional councils. And I think that's the way forward. We all have a vested interest in it from all sorts of different angles. But if the people don't use those rivers for white baiting, then their value diminishes. And we need to be very, very mindful of that too.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Māori Ora.
That was Hans Rook speaking on whitebait and a possible alternative.